From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank of The National Journal and Michael Williams of CBS Radio, Radio News contributor. And here are the issues. Saying that decisions look different when you're sitting in the Oval Office, Donald Trump abandoned his previous campaign promise to pull American troops out of Afghanistan. Instead, the president said he would win the war in that country, though he didn't say with how many new troops. In a fiery speech in Arizona, Donald Trump threatened to shut down the federal government if Congress does not fund his plans for a wall on the Mexican border, and called leaders of his own Republican Party weak. An American Navy admiral was relieved of his command after the latest fatal accident at sea involving a warship from the U.S. Pacific Fleet, raising questions about seamanship in the world's most powerful navy. So it's been a busy week of speeches and policy announcements by President Trump. Let's begin with the conventional work of any American president, which is the business of war and peace and sending troops overseas. Donald Trump is now the third American president to find himself at war in Afghanistan, 16 years now, no obvious victory in sight. And Tom, Donald Trump on the campaign trail was pretty clear that this was the kind of foreign adventure that he thought was a distraction from the work of making America great again, and that it would be rather simple to just pull the troops out of Afghanistan and wash America's hands of that country. Was that what he said when he addressed the country earlier this week?
No, not at all, David. As a matter of fact, this is a rare case of President Trump confronting reality and the reality causing him to change his view on a critical issue of governance. It's no secret that President Trump has been angry for months about Afghanistan. He's been yelling at aides, yelling at generals, threatening to fire the four-star general running the Afghan campaign for the U.S. and its allies. And he keeps saying, why can't we win? I want to win. And one of President Trump's mantras is, let's win. I want to win. And I think President Trump has very reluctantly come to the conclusion that not losing in Afghanistan may be the best any president can do right now. So he said a lot of things that I thought I would never hear him say, but he's clearly not pulling out. I think he would like to, but he now understands that he can't. So it was a moment of clarity for a president who understands that none of the options are great in Afghanistan, but the worst option would be just pulling out.
So, Michael, as Tom points out, that the president almost explicitly said, you know, I don't like to change my mind and my instincts were to pull everyone out. He said he was sending more troops. Do we know how many more troops and for how long and what their mission is? How much detail did the president give beyond saying that he had a plan to win?
None. No, we don't know how many troops. And the amount of detail was none. What he said was that he would not give dates and he would not give troop levels. What he did say was that he would base his decisions on conditions on the ground, which is, to be honest, what every single president who's been involved in this has done. You do this based on conditions on the ground. So in that sense, in terms of the rhetoric, it's no different than what anybody else is doing. But there was no specificity on it. He did say, though, that he was not going to pull out, as Tom rightly said. This is a big deal. I do want to be fair to the president, though, and say that I do think that he said that we were going to deal with what he called principled reality, principled realism, something like this, where, look, he's not into nation building anymore. The period of nation building is over was one of his quotes. And yes, we have spent a lot of money. We, the U.S. and the United States, have spent a lot of money in this area, $6 trillion by some estimates. And I think he doesn't want to put down a layer of liberal democracy in Afghanistan. That has been a goal of, say, like President Bush 43. He does not want to attempt to do that. He wants to secure this place and make it something other than a hotbed for terrorism. And I do give him credit for that approach.
So those days, Tom, where American presidents, you know, going back to George W. Bush, would talk about the mission was to make sure that little Afghan girls could all go to school, that they were going to build a kind of functioning multi-party democracy. That kind of level of ambition is gone now. This is a pure counterterrorism mission.
I mean, I think the Trump administration wants to do something about young women being able to fully participate in that society, but that's in a limited sense. I mean, he made it clear he's out of the business of creating a little U.S. in this region of the world. But he is dialed back, but he understands that he can't pull out. The leaks from the Pentagon suggest that about 4,000 to 4,500 additional American troops will be going, nothing like the 30,000 troop surge that President Obama ordered up. Many of these will be special operators, special forces, Navy SEALs, and working on counterterrorism. I think there's going to be more Central Intelligence operatives in Afghanistan as well, but not going to be a lot of full-bore troop units, but there will be more Americans on the ground.
And just because you mentioned the CIA, which is obviously the CIA has been very active in Afghanistan for a long time, that reminds us that one way he did slightly make news was he said some harsher than usual comments about the role of Pakistan.
That was
next door to Afghanistan, a country where the CIA has an incredibly complex, unhappy, half-ally, half sort of enemy relationship with the Pakistani security services, intelligence services, often accused of sponsoring terrorism in India and in Afghanistan. What did President Trump say about Pakistan that sounded harsher than usual?
What he basically said was, we all know Pakistan has been harboring terrorists, it's given them safe havens, and they have to stop that. And the real news item was, and again, I'm paraphrasing him, what he was basically saying is, if Pakistan doesn't step up and knock this off and cooperate more with us against ISIS and other terrorists, we're going to ask India to help too. Well, you know, that's like, to talk about a red flag, that's multiple red flags. We all know India and Pakistan are not close for a variety of reasons. They both have nuclear arsenals. They don't get along. And so for the president to basically say, if you don't do what needs to be done, we're going to ask India to help step in, which, of course, is music to India's ears, which would be anathema to Pakistan. And whatever else that did, whether it was smart or not, it certainly got Pakistan's attention. We'll have to see what happens from here. But that was a big marker the president laid down to the government in Islamabad.
Michael, tell us about the role of generals, whether they are still serving in uniform or whether they are retired kind of four-star generals. This is an unusually kind of brass-heavy West Wing. No, we have, you know, generals as National Security Advisor. We have a general as Defense Secretary. We have a general as Chief of Staff. Actually, Marine generals in many cases. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs is a Marine general. So the Marines are kind of running quite a lot of stuff at the moment. Is there a sense that President Trump, why does he surround himself with generals? And what is the role that they are playing in terms of making him a more conventional foreign policy president?
From his initial appointments in his cabinet and in his administration, you could see that he's very impressed by these men, by their accomplishments, by their demeanor. And they are impressive people. Almost anybody, when you meet these people, would be impressed by them. I think he's especially impressed by their gravitas, by their sense of authority. And we all know that he really is impressed by that authoritarian type of figure. We do have a preponderance of generals, I think, that we haven't had for quite a long time, even having to pass legislation to get one of these generals as the head of the Defense Department, General Mattis. It has a calming effect, I think, on some people now, thinking that, you know, with a president who many consider to be, quote unquote, unstable, unpredictable, these types of words get thrown around, to have people who are seen as knowledgeable, experienced, calm, reasonable at the helm and sort of providing a buffer between the unpredictable and the sustainable and reasonable. However, I think it is a concern when you have a military presence that has military experience. These are not diplomats by trade. They're not statesmen by trade. And they are very familiar with military solutions. And I think a number of people have a concern about there being a preponderance of these generals because it leads us down a road where we have this military bent in our foreign policy.
And Tom, you're kind of almost better qualified than anyone else I can think of because you've covered White Houses going back decades. You're also ex-military yourself. Can generals save a bad president from himself? Can generals on their own save the country? And how has that worked in the past when generals have held these, you know, high-ranking jobs in White House?
It's a mixed bag, David. I mean, I remember being in the White House briefing room the day that retired General Alexander Haig came out and said he was in charge after Ronald Reagan had been shot. Some would say that Haig saved the country during Watergate by propping up President Nixon and getting him to the finish line of resignation. in lieu of impeachment. But that was a rocky time. On the other hand, nobody had really any objections when Colin Powell, one of the longtime stars in the American military, but who had an extended career in diplomacy. He was a deputy national security advisor in a previous life. Nobody had a real problem when he was running the State Department. So it all depends. But to answer your question, David, specifically, these generals are helpful because of Trump being Trump. I mean, he is, as Michael says, unpredictable. If I was forced to only use one word to describe the first 7 months of the Trump administration, I would have to say chaotic. And senior military officials are, by definition, the antithesis of chaos. They're orderly, they're structured, they're disciplined. That's why General Kelly is doing a good job trying to make the Montessori school of the White House staff a more accomplished, organized place. So in this environment where you have a president with no military experience, who had deferments during the Vietnam era, he needs these generals. He needs their strengths. But from an institutional standpoint, it is quite true. The U.S. Constitution and American tradition makes clear that civilians run the military. And so from a good government standpoint, this is something that I think that will be debated in the years to come. But this is important now. These generals provide some much-needed ballast to President Trump for now.
It's true, as a foreign correspondent, when you hear people saying, you know, it'll be fine because the generals are more sensible than the president, you start to think, my goodness, this sounds like we're talking about Turkey or the Philippines or something. You know, don't worry, the military will keep us on track. We'll have more in just a minute from the panel. And first, a reminder that you are listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, with The Economist. And joining me today are Tom DeFrank of the National Journal and Michael Williams of CBS Radio. This is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Listen to it, and then tell us what you think by taking a short survey on our Facebook page, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. So that was Presidential Trump talking about Afghanistan, the sort of the normal business of a president. But he gave a speech 24 hours later in Arizona, in Phoenix, in the same convention center where I watched him last year give a really ferocious campaign speech about immigration and how he was going to potentially round up millions of people in the country without the right papers. He was pretty fiery again, wasn't he, Michael, when he was talking about this kind of 76-minute rant, some reporters called it. He did spend a lot of time attacking the media, that's one thing. But he had some very specific messages for Congress, including his own party, the Republicans, in Congress, about what he might do if they don't give him the money to start building his wall with the border in Mexico. Tell us about this very fiery speech and what it might mean kind of looking ahead to the rest of this year between the White House and Congress.
Well, again, such a dramatic contrast between the speech that was given about Afghanistan and then you have what some people would call the real Donald Trump, the most comfortable Donald Trump for him and his supporters, out essentially as in a campaign type of environment on a stage with nothing but boosters in the room, talking to those people, his base, his fervent base. The subject here in Arizona, where it's a very visceral subject when you talk about immigration and the fact not only that we're talking about how it affects the economy, it's a cultural issue. Let's be honest about it. People feel that there is a shift from a culture that is dominated by people who are north of the border, from north of the border to south of the border. They feel it's turning into a state of Mexico. Donald Trump went after the wall that he wants for immigration, threatening to shut down the government. If he doesn't get the money in the budget for it, for building this wall, he will essentially shut down the government, not approve a spending bill, and basically hold the country hostage for this wall. I find it fascinating that we've gone from the point in the campaign where we're saying that Mexico will definitely pay for this wall, we'll build it and Mexico will pay for it, to we will build this wall ourselves and we will pay for it, or I will withhold money from veterans, from Social Security recipients, from retired people. It's an astonishing shift in who's going to pay for it and what it really means to him.
And Tom, so if there are listeners out there who think, hang on, Donald Trump's a Republican, he controls the White House. The Republicans, his own party, control Congress, they control both chambers of Congress. Why can't they just hand him the money for this wall that is one of his signature promises? Why is he having to threaten and bluster, and why is he attacking the leaders of his own party for not delivering this money? What's the holdup?
Well, for a couple of reasons, David. One, the wall is very unpopular. All the public opinion polls show that almost by a 2-to-1 majority, most Americans think building a wall and spending billions of dollars on that is a bad idea. They don't like the idea. The other problem with this is shutting down the government would be a political catastrophe. Every time it's happened before, a couple of times, Republicans were associated with shutting down the government, and they paid heavily at the polls in the next congressional election. I had breakfast yesterday with one of the leading Republican mandarins in Washington, who was a Trump supporter, not initially, but he's become a fervent Trump supporter. And he says to shut the government down would cause Republicans to lose the House of Representatives in the 2018 midterm elections. They would be blamed. President Trump would be blamed. And the congressional leadership is not going to go along with this. The other thing that should be said is, yes, the Republicans control Congress, but there are too many Democrats who are opposed to this. The Republicans don't have the votes to ram something like this through.
So what you're saying, Tom, is that particularly in the Senate, where if you want to get a budget passed and vote new money for the government so that the government doesn't shut down, doesn't run out of money, that's what that would mean, because of the rules of the Senate, it's not enough just to have 51 out of 100 votes. You need to have 60
right.
out of 100 votes, because the Founding Fathers wanted it to be hard to pass things through the Senate. The Republicans have 52, so they have a tiny, tiny majority. So to get most ordinary things passed through the Senate, they need some Democrats to join them. So would any Democrats at the moment vote money through for a border wall?
You never know until the vote is taken, but probably not. But there's another factor here, David, we should talk about very briefly, and that is relations between Senate Republican leaders, specifically Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and President Trump, have totally deteriorated. The New York Times recently had a story saying that there was a huge telephonic shouting match laced with epithets on both sides between President Trump and Senator McConnell. Trump has been tweeting about suggesting that McConnell is weak, and it's not healthy. And there is great resentment also in the Republican caucus in the Senate for the way President Trump has been criticizing Senator John McCain, who's under treatment for brain cancer at the moment. And so relations between Congress and the White House are strained. I mean, I think the president has not done a good job of setting aside building walls, building bridges. I think the state of building bridges between Republican leaders in Congress and the president has not gone well, and that makes everything ever more difficult. Also, I think if you shut down the government, it's going to have a real negative effect on prospects for tax reform, which is key to the Republicans.
And Michael, I think we should point out, for people who don't know Mitch McConnell, this Senate leader who supposedly has had these shouting match phone calls, this is not a shouting kind of guy. Mitch McConnell is kind of ice cold, kind of chess playing kind of strategist. If he set his desk on fire, he probably wouldn't shout at you. But, you know, this is unusual. One of the things that President Trump is saying is that he wants to change the voting rules in the Senate completely. He thinks the Senate should do away with this supermajority thing so that it becomes, you know, just like the other chamber in Congress, and much more kind of partisan votes on kind of 51 votes will do it. A lot of senators, 60-something senators, have written a letter saying that would be a disastrously bad idea. Why don't they want to do what their president is asking them to do and make it easier to get stuff done on pure party lines in the Senate?
Well, leave it to you, David, to find what I think is the real nugget in that entire speech, which is the suggestion that the filibuster needs to be gotten rid of.
Which is the kind of Washington language for this rule that you have to have effectively
60 votes.
Block, or you can block work in the Senate.
The opposing party can block legislation. That is how the Senate is meant to work. They have changed it on occasion, and Mitch McConnell famously changed that to get Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. That was done, I believe, by...
And to be fair, the Democrats before changed the rules for getting new people through nominated under Barack Obama.
As I say, it has been done from time to time. But to make it the order of the day, where you need 51 votes or 50 votes plus the president of the Senate, which is the vice president, Mike Pence, means that now you don't have a Senate. You don't have the cooling sauce that Alexander Hamilton talked about. Mm-hmm. You don't have the greatest deliberative body in the world, as many have called it. What you have is an extension of the House of Representatives where majority rules. And it would be a disaster. It would truly be a disaster, I think, for the deliberative and legislative process in the United States. And each party would feel that way as they lose power.
So, Tom, I think it's fair to say we all meet senators and people on Capitol Hill who do not want to make this change, who do not want to undo this kind of essential founding principle of the Senate and make it into this kind of much more partisan body that votes on a narrow majority. Are the senators going to resist Donald Trump? Are they going to stay the Senate, or are they going to bow to the political pressure he's putting on them?
They will not, because the political pressure, you know, politicians are the ultimate political animal by definition, and they see public opinion polls that show that while there's probably 25% of the country, as the Phoenix rally showed, who love President Trump, who will believe anything he says, that core support is starting to decline ever so slightly, but it's declining. And Trump's numbers with the rest of the country, his disapproval rating continues to go up. And so I think members of Congress are no longer afraid of President Trump. If they were afraid of him, you wouldn't have so many members of Congress popping off about him. So they read the political winds.
So finally, let's turn to a very shocking, very sad story involving the U.S. Navy on the far side of the world in the Pacific. We saw that it means something in the U.S. Navy, where you take responsibility as the commander for things that go wrong. So we had a fatal collision, killing 10 American sailors between the USS John S. McCain, an Aegis-class destroyer, which hit a very large cargo ship. 10 sailors died. And the admiral in charge of the 7th Fleet was made to leave office a few weeks early. He was actually due to retire. That seems pretty tough. He wasn't on that ship. Why is the American Navy sacking admirals, and why are they having so many collisions in the Pacific?
That is really the question, is it not, that's being investigated now. I think they've called it a deliberate reset that's happening now in the Pacific to review everything from the mechanical and software systems that manage these ships and the navigation, the navigational practices that are going, and even sort of the, I think they call it the human resources, bridge human resources, which means who's watching, you know, really. I mean, how do you not have somebody who sees a ship and you don't collide with it? So all of these things are under attack. I think it's a very unusual step, though, to have a vice admiral in this case, Joe Aquin. If you look at his record, and I looked him up, he is a graduate of the Top Gun Flight School, the highest Navy flight school, I think 150 combat missions, virtually every high decoration that you could have in combat. And for this guy to be dismissed with 3 weeks left in retirement and basically in disgrace is really an unusual step. So we are looking for answers. But from what we can determine so far is that it has not been shown that there is anything like terrorism. There's anything like sabotage. And they appear still to be accidents. And that's why someone is being held responsible for them.
David, it's interesting to me, as Michael has said, there's been a series of these. The most important one before was involving the destroyer Fitzgerald, in which there was a similar crash collision with a commercial ship, and 7 sailors died. And that was only a handful of weeks ago. The Pentagon has been saying for years that the Navy is spread too thin between Iraq and Afghanistan and all this up-tempo stuff, that we don't have enough ships and seamen are stressed. I don't know about that, but I do know, as Michael says, what I want to know is, where is the radar? Radar should be picking up you're in the proximity of a ship this big. And I mean, this was early in the morning. It was totally dark out there. But still, there's something wrong. And the Navy, more than any of the other services, rather than sweep stuff under the rug, demand accountability. And basically, this goes back to the Royal Navy. The captain's responsible for everything, even if he was on shore leave when something bad happened.
And Michael, we should set this in context. One of the reasons that it's shocking that the American Navy is having these collisions in the Pacific is that this is the same theater where the American Navy is up against the Chinese Navy and is showing the flag for the entire of the West and is supposedly able to deliver calibrated doses of resolve and power. So if the American Navy looks incompetent, that has kind of geopolitical impacts.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is the Vice Admiral, Joseph Aquin, who said in a speech earlier this year that if there's going to be a conflict, it's going to be in my theater. So it's of concern.
So this is a serious thing. Well, that's all the time we have, unfortunately. Thanks to Tom DeFrank of the National Journal and Michael Williams, CBS Radio News contributor here in Washington. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and I'm David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. Thanks for listening.